There we go. So for the next 6 weeks on Wednesdays, we're going to be reading together and talking about a Tibetan text written in the 13th century by a monk called Tokme Zongpo. And this is the book that we'll be kind of focusing on. It's actually, the actual writing by Zongpo is a series of verses, 37 verses. And it's titled 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. And I first read this text a number of years ago, and it has a commentary also by Ken MacLeod, who's the translator, Tibetan practitioner for decades. Also a friend of Norman's as well. Anyway, so I read this a number of years ago when I was doing a solo retreat. And I was deeply moved both by the verses and by Ken MacLeod's commentary on this. So I hope over these 6 weeks, you too will find much in this that will enrich your practice. Now, you don't need to run out and buy the book, although I like it. I'll be giving you copies of the verses, so you'll be able to kind of follow along with that, and then I'll be, and Kate, we're going to do this together. Kate will do next week. We'll be alternating, talking about the verses, and particularly looking at them perhaps. I don't know if I could say from a Zen sensibility, but that's my main practice, so I guess it's going to come out. And Ken MacLeod's is more from a Tibetan point of view. So if you're interested in getting the book, I recommend it as well, but you don't have to. So I'd like to begin, first of all, by kind of a shout-out to Dzogchen Norman Fisher, who is the founding teacher of Mountain Rain Zen Community and the teacher who ordained Kate and me. A shout out to Norman because he gave us this wonderful example of exploring and sharing Buddhist texts and practices from many different streams of this great Buddhist tradition. Sometimes Norman has talked about the early texts, the early Pali texts, other times the Tibetan texts, etc. So he really has brought in and fearlessly talked about many of the practices that are not found within Zen Buddhism as such. So in Asia, the different schools of Buddhist thought and practices generally had very little contact with each other. Once they were kind of established, right? So even within, I was reading this recently, even within the Tibetan group of schools or sects or traditions, often they didn't have too much contact with each other. This is relatively recently that this has happened within the Tibetan tradition. And I know, for example, in Japan, it would say be very unusual for a Zen monastic to be familiar with the teachings of the Pure Land School. They'd have a little bit of knowledge, but you know, they wouldn't read them or study them or do that kind of practice. Or someone from the Nichiren School, which is kind of focused on the Lotus Sutra, chanting the Lotus Sutra, they wouldn't engage in other practices found in other forms of Japanese Buddhism. And I suspect this is true all throughout Asia, at least until modern times. It was pretty much you kept to your own practice, your own tradition, whatever that was. However, since the Buddhist, various Buddhist traditions have arrived in Europe and in North America, all of those various schools have come in close contact and have begun to mutually influence each other. today. So lucky us, we have quite a buffet of practices and teachings that we can look at. The buffet, though, is dangerous, right? You can always overeat too much, or eat too much of the wrong thing, and it takes a little bit of discipline. But I'll talk about that perhaps at another time. So just a few words, first of all, about the author, Tokme Zongpo, about this old text. I find it really interesting that there are a number of parallels between the early lives of Eihei Dogen, the Japanese monk who kind of basically started this particular practice that we engage in Japan way back in the 1200s. So parallels between his life, between Dogen's life, and Tokme Zongpo's life. So Tokme Zongpo was born to a poor Tibetan family back in 1295, just 45 years after Dogen died in Kyoto, in Japan. And like Dogen, Zongpo's mother died when he was very young. And just a few years later, his father also passed away. And at the age of 9, Zongpo entered a monastery where he learned to read and write. And when he was 14, he was granted novice vows, and a little bit later became fully ordained. And Dogen, likewise, entered a monastery when he was just 13 and studied Buddhism on Mount Hiei, which was the main center of Buddhist studies and practice in Japan at that time. So they both started practicing very young, and both in monastic environments. And like Dogen, Zongpo was by all accounts a very brilliant student. We don't know much about his life as an adult, other than he became abbot of a very large monastery for about 9 years, and then he stepped down so that he could live in retreat as a hermit. And he did that for the next 20 years, mostly solitary practice. Although he did continue to teach some, people would come to him for teachings, and he continued to write. And apparently, he was well known for his great generosity, that he would give whatever he had to anyone who asked. And there's a legend, I don't know how true it is, that beggars would avoid him or not ask because they knew he would give everything away to them if they asked. And they deeply respected his teachings. And so they didn't come begging to his door very often. And like Dogen, Zongpo was a great writer and author. He wrote over 100 works before he died, at the age of 67. And one of these works is the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva that we're going to be looking at. Now, these 37 verses that we're going to look at are really, I think, a very beautifully condensed work that makes clear the way of a bodhisattva and gives advice on how we can emulate this practice in our own lives. So I think most people know the word bodhisattva, but it's a Sanskrit word for a being who is devoted to becoming awake and to acting for the benefit of all that lives. The way of the bodhisattva is one of the most radical, I think, and powerful forms of Buddhist practice, because central to it is the welfare of others, as well as oneself. In our Zen tradition, we frequently recite the four bodhisattva vows, especially at the end of any formal Dharma talk, right? On Sundays when we give a formal Dharma talk, right? Beings are numberless, I vow to save them, etc., etc. Well, here's what the Dalai Lama regularly recites as his, well, they're not exactly his, but as bodhisattva vows. And these are based on the beloved 6th century Indian sage Shantideva. And you've probably heard these before, but let me just say, it's so beautiful. May I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those who wish to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all who are sick, a vase of plenty, a tree of miracles, and for the boundless multitudes of living beings, may I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and the sky until all beings are free, freed from sorrow, and all are awakened. Has a lot more poetic punch than our four vows, I think, but still the same wonderful, heart-opening, endless vow. So the verses that we're going to be looking at, these verses by Tsongkhapa, present, I think, a kind of a clear and practical guide, giving advice and cautions for us as we enter the path of practice. And it's relatively short text, but many teachers in the Tibetan tradition, including the Dalai Lama, have written commentaries on this text, recognizing the great value in spending a lifetime of perfecting these teachings that lead us to wisdom and to compassion. So Ken MacLeod, the translator and commentator, kind of sees the text divided up like this. And I'll give the text out in just a moment here. The first 9 verses, he says, set out the discipline and practices that establish a really solid foundation for spiritual growth. And the next 10 to 18 verses introduce the taking and sending practice, which are tongmen, a practice in which you visualize taking in the suffering of others and sending out ease and comfort. And we'll talk about this practice in the coming weeks. And then the next section of verses, 19 to 24, focus on emotional reactions and the nature of existence. And then the last, well, not quite the last, but the next 25 to 30, is on the 6 perfections, which we have talked about here before, but generosity, morality, patience, vigor, concentration, and wisdom. They're very common throughout the Mahayana tradition, also in the Zen tradition. And then the next 5 verses discuss general practices, and then there's a verse of dedication. But at any rate, let's begin. So, if Susu, could you do the screen share just for the first page? And could you take one of these and just give one to each person? Okay, ready to go? Okay, so at the very beginning here, Namo Lokeshvara, homage. You who see that experience has no coming or going, yet pour your energy solely into helping beings, my excellent teachers and Lord all-seeing, I ever humbly honor with my body, speech, and mind. So this, what is essentially a long poem, begins with honoring Lokiteshvara, which is simply another name for Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Tsongpo, in his homage, tells us that Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, sees deeply the emptiness of all things. In the Heart Sutra that we chant every Sunday, Avalokiteshvara tells Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. The Heart Sutra tells us that things appear to exist in some solid way, but that's an illusion. That they have, it's an illusion that they have some inherent existence, and that illusion that we get caught with is really the deep source of our suffering. That somehow these things have an inherent existence. Example summarizes this by saying no coming, no going. He said there really is nothing that's coming or going. And I was thinking about this. It's like a river. Do we say a river comes and goes? You stand by the river, right? And it's just this constant flow of movement. We say a bird comes and goes, and we get, oh yeah, that's the bird, and it's going, and they're gone. But maybe that's not quite right. There's a famous koan in the Zen tradition where the master hears a noise and he says, "What was that?" And his assistant says something, "Oh, that's a bird flying away." And the master grabs his nose, gives it a twist, and says, "What's this? Don't get caught." There is nothing coming and going. And of course, that's true of us too. There is nothing coming and going. Just this moment here. But and of course in our mind, we remember all the stuff that happened in the past. We've got all these plans for the future. Can be a great source of our suffering. But Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, sees there is no coming and going, no arising nor ceasing, no birth, no death, and offers her whole life and compassion to helping all beings caught in delusion. And as very common in many Buddhist texts and practices, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, Ngzampo offers respect through body, speech, and mind. Sometimes known as the three doors, body, speech, and mind. This is our way that we offer ourselves to the world, through our body, our speech, and our mind. So a very common beginning. So let's move on to the next thing here, which, I forget what it's called, intention. Yeah. Full awakening, Buddha, the source of joy and well-being, come as you master the noble way. Because mastery depends on knowing how to practice, I now explain the practice of all bodhisattvas. Well, I think this passage is pretty clear. He's just, first of all, he brings forth the Buddha as a kind of model for us. a way of life to emulate the Buddha's life. And then he tells us, I'm going to give you instruction. Because he's going to give you instruction because by understanding these bodhisattva practices that I'm going to give you, you will advance on the bodhisattva path and one day become full awakened bodhisattvas, able to help everyone else. Kind of sweet, I thought. It's like an instruction manual. At last, an instruction manual. Unlike the Zen tradition, the Tibetan tradition tends to talk in terms of a carefully laid out path with instructions to follow. Kind of like signposts given along the way, right? So, okay, I'm on C3 right now and about to enter D1. Kind of carefully laid out. It's delightful and very refreshing when, after years of practice in the Zen tradition. So let's have a look at verse 1. Right now you have a good boat, fully equipped and available, hard to find. To free yourself and others from the sea of samsara, day and night constantly study, reflect, and meditate. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. What is this good boat that each of us possesses? Well, we have the precious human life. A life that is particularly suitable for practicing the Dharma. And the body is likened to a boat. You'll like this one, Michael, right? The body is likened to a boat or a great ship that is able to sail across the sea of samsara, across the suffering of this existence to awakening, and to, of course, help others. In the Tibetan view, and certainly in the Mahayana view in general, human life is free of the realms of great suffering and free of the realms of too much happiness. If we're born in the realm of really great suffering, the hellish realms or the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, the mind is too distracted, either by ignorance or suffering, to be able to really do spiritual practice. And if we're born in the God realm, where beings have incredible sensual pleasure and mental pleasure, then we're too distracted by the pleasure to really focus on freeing ourselves or practicing the path. I think this is true. And we see this, people caught in the hell realm here, right? Too much suffering to be able to perhaps follow a spiritual practice. And although we probably don't see these people every day, but people caught in the godlike realm, right? All the pleasure, all, everything they want immediately there. Again, too distracted to practice. What realm are you in? In the last line, Zongpo admonishes us, don't waste time. And Ken MacLeod, the commentator, writes at the end of his commentary to this verse, what will it take for you to step into the boat? What will it take for you to step into the boat? So I'm just going to do two more verses, give you a chance to talk. So verse 2, Attraction to those close to you catches you in its currents. Aversion to those who oppose you burns inside. Indifference that ignores what needs to be done is a black hole. Leave your homeland. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Well, you may have already recognized that in this verse, Zangpo is reminding us of the three poisons, or also known as the three unwholesome roots, which in Sanskrit are raga or greed, clinging, attachment, and devsha, aversion or hate, that kind of thing, and moha, which means delusion or ignorance. So these are very common in early Buddhism. All through all Buddhist traditions have talked about these three poisons. So Zangpo tells us, for example, that when we cling to a person, like, you know, I love you so much I can't be without you. When we cling to a person, we are stirred up like churning water. Anxious the relationship may end, for example, or longing, always longing to be with somebody, for example, you know, that kind of, and needing them to be a certain way. Many examples of that kind of clinging to a relationship or a person. And of course, the opposite, when we may perhaps happen to be upset with somebody, and at that moment, even though 5 minutes earlier we said, I love you, we kind of burn with anger or frustration. Perhaps they disturbed our concentration, right? We're watching TV. Or interfered with us from getting what we want. That person you kind of have a good relationship in the office with got the promotion. You didn't. We all know, I think, what it's like to kind of seethe with anger, not give it voice, but kind of stew. Or maybe we also know what it likes to shout in rage. How could you? Rah, 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 rah. And indifference or ignorance prevents us from truly seeing the causes of suffering. So we're unable to know when we need to abandon or discard something, or when we need to embrace something. Because we're just too distracted. We may try intoxicating ourselves with drugs, alcohol, media, multiple relationships, thinking, well, this may help, which further hinder us from seeing the true causes of suffering. Leaving your homeland refers to leaving these habitual three poisons that catch us up. And we do this by, just as we did a few minutes ago, being aware of our body, our breath, being aware of our hearts and minds so that we don't engage in harmful speech, actions. Ken MacLeod writes at the end of his short commentary for this verse, when you are able to experience these poisons and not act on them, you have left your homeland. One last verse, and then we'll have people talk a little bit here. Verse 3. Don't engage disturbances and emotional reactions gradually fade away. Don't engage distractions and spiritual practice gradually grows. Keep awareness clear and vivid, and confidence in the way arises. Rely on silence. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So Zangpo here advises us not to feed our painful thoughts and emotions. Aware of the ever looping story, we make effort to put it down. Perhaps we question the veracity of this story. Is this really true? Perhaps by offering loving kindness and compassion to ourselves. I beat myself up enough with this. May I be at ease. Or perhaps it's someone else you need to offer compassion to. Perhaps by acknowledging this suffering is simply part of the human condition, shared by countless others. I am not alone in this. Perhaps by returning awareness to the present moment and just looking out your window at trees, or maybe feeling a warm cup of tea in your hands. At the end, let's end with a comment on this verse by Ken MacLeod. He writes, when you do not engage them, your disturbances and distractions, when you do not engage them, you become aware of a silence. A silence that is always there, even in your darkest moments. A silence that includes everything and cannot be fathomed. A silence that allows you to listen to your heart, to your body and mind in a way you did not know was possible. So I'll stop here. And we have enough time, I think, for us to get into small groups. I'll ask the Eno to put people in Zoom into small groups. People in Zoom, if you can stay, please stay. And if not, please leave now so that we can get into groups easily. And here's two questions to consider. What will it take, or did it take, for you to step into the boat? What did it take, or what will it take for you to step into the boat? That's one question, if you want to talk about that. Second one, another possibility is, how do you take in the Dharma? And what supports you in this practice? How do you learn? How do you take in the Dharma? And what supports you in this practice? So either one of those questions or anything else that I yammered on about tonight is fine.